nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Well, welcome to EE656. I'm Professor Lundstrom. So I guess you all know that. So you can see that I'm mostly going to be doing PowerPoint lectures this semester. And I'm actually, you know, I'm in the process of refining and finalizing these. There is a set online already for this course when I taught it 2 years ago. Eventually, hopefully by the next time, I'll get to the point where everything is online and we'll use class time to work problems and have discussions. But we're not there yet. Okay. So mostly it's going to go through PowerPoint, and let me just explain to you today what this course is all about, see if there are any questions. This will all be posted, so people are free to use this material as long as they follow the licensing, which is very flexible and open, but we just include that. Okay, so you've all had some exposure to semiconductor devices and physics. And you may remember the drift diffusion equation. So this is often what we take in beginning courses to be the fundamental description of how electrons and holes flow in a semiconductor. So J sub P is the hole current. The first term is drift in an electric field. And the second term is diffusion down a concentration gradient. It looks very physical, and we teach MOSFETs and bipolar transistors and solar cells and most everything, starting with equations like this. So this is a course about transport. This is a transport equation. And we're going to be describing, you know, we're going to be asking some questions. We're going to be trying to understand this equation in a little more detail. You know, where does this equation come from? It looks plausible, but when you just write it down and say that looks reasonable, you don't really have a good feel for what assumptions you've made. What if there's a magnetic field? We oftentimes want to characterize materials in the presence of a magnetic field. We learn a lot about the material that way. What if there's a temperature gradient? Sometimes we do that intentionally to build a device, like a thermoelectric cooler or whatever. Sometimes they're just there because we can't eliminate them. Two of the parameters here are mobility and diffusion coefficient. If we're working with a new material, if we're working with silicon, we look up in a book and we find out, okay, the mobility for lightly doped silicon is 1360 centimeters squared per volt second. If I dope it to 10 to the 18th, you look on the table and you see what the doping is. It's all well characterized experimentally. We just look up the answer. What if you're dealing with a new material? Or what if you're dealing with a material for which there's very little data? How do you compute the mobility? How is it related to the material parameters? You probably recall that D and mu are related by this thing called an Einstein relation, right? When does that work? Where does it come from? It doesn't work all the time. What do you do when it doesn't work? And, you know, under what conditions does this equation fail? And exactly what happens when it fails? And then what do you do if you can't use it? So part of what, you know, when you get beyond the very first semiconductor courses, you'd like to understand some of the concepts we introduced there in a little more detail. Because if you're working on state-of-the-art technology development or if you're working on research problems, the answer is probably not in the standard textbooks. You have to go beyond it. And that's what we want to develop in this course, an understanding and appreciation for how current flows so that we can deal with those new problems. So the objectives of the course are, it's just an introduction to the fundamental concepts of how charge flows in semiconductor materials and devices. And we can't discuss everything. You know, this is a topic that has an awful lot of material that we could discuss. We can't possibly cover it in one semester. But what I'm hoping that we can do is to give you a foundation so that you know the way to think about these problems, you know the starting point, and you know for the rest of your careers you're going to be working on research problems for which you have to educate yourself on what you need to know. You'll be out in industry working on new technologies. You won't have the luxury of taking a course. You'll have to figure out how you figure out things for yourself, and hopefully you'll have enough of a foundation that you know basically how to think about problems and where to go to find out more. Now, it's really designed, or it's my intent anyway, that this is not a course for students that want to write computer programs that simulate devices, even though some of you here do a lot of that, and I've done a lot of that in my career. But it's really a course for students that are interested in building, designing, analyzing, and maybe simulating devices. You know, how do you think about electronic materials and devices and understand what's happening? Well, if you're using a simulation program, which is an integral part of everything we do these days, how do you use it intelligently? How do you know which options to check? How do you know when it gives you answers you can't believe? Things like that. Okay, so this is a very brief outline. Let me pass out the syllabus. And I'll just, you know, give you some sense as to the topics that we're going to be talking about. The first week I'm going to, you know, very quickly we're going to review some basic concepts that we will use for the remainder of the course. I know some of you are emailing me and asking, you know, do I have the right background for this course? The best way to determine if you have the right background to the course is to take the first week and, you know, do the first homework problem or two. And if you feel comfortable that you can handle that, you've probably got a sufficient background. If it looks completely foreign to you, you've never seen anything like this before, then, you know, you probably need to take 606 or 495, Professor Dada's course, Fundamentals of Nanoelectronics, or courses like that. So after we do a quick review, that there are three main parts of the course. The first part is about near equilibrium transport. I'll describe what that is in a minute, and you can see the general kinds of things that we're talking about there. The second course is much more on the physics of how electrons and holes scatter in a semiconductor. And then the third part gets into what happens in real devices. So roughly three parts, a little more on part one because a lot of the fundamental concepts occur there, but roughly three equal parts. Okay, all right, so this might be an IV characteristic that you might measure on some semiconductor or some resistor. So some generic IV relation. So there's some region where the current is linearly proportional to voltage. I is equal to conductance times voltage, or voltage divided by resistance. Everything is nice and simple there. That's what we would call low field transport, because it usually applies when we have a very small electric field in the semiconductor. Or we call it near equilibrium transport, because we've just applied small voltages and we're not too far away from equilibrium. Or sometimes people just call it linear transport. Okay, but if you keep cranking the voltage up, that doesn't stay linear forever. You'll get up, if you have very high electric fields or very large applied voltages, other things will happen. The simplest thing that would happen is that the current might just saturate. And you probably remember from your semiconductor courses that there's this thing called velocity saturation in silicon. You apply a very high electric field, carriers get a lot of scattering, you just can't make them go any faster. The velocity just saturates at what value? Yeah, about 1 times 10 to the 7th centimeters per second. Okay, unless now if you're working with gallium arsenide or some other 3-5 semiconductor, the IV characteristic will look a little different. The slope will generally be much higher at small voltages, that's coming from a higher mobility. But it might have some very unusual non-monotonic shape. And the velocity might never saturate, but it might actually have a peak value that's considerably higher than its high field value. And that has to do with how electrons are transferring from one valley to another valley, and we'll talk about that also. So that regime is called sometimes high field transport or hot carrier transport, because if you think of the energy of an electron as being related to its temperature, 3/2 KT or something like that, the temperature must be very hot. Okay, so the first part of the course is about this. The second part of the course, we do this and a little bit more. And in between, we talk about physics of scattering just a little bit. So let me remind you of some things you're probably familiar with in a basic course. Let's say I have a slab of semiconductor, just a chunk of semiconductor, big, long sample, has a cross-sectional area A. We apply a positive voltage on the right end. It's N-type, so electrons are the charge carriers. If I apply a positive voltage here, they're going to attract electrons. The electrons are going to flow out the contact, so the current flows in. Right? Just a little resistor. Okay. Now, typically, electrons scatter a lot. They don't just flow ballistically like a cannonball across the resistor. They scatter off of lots of things, lattice vibrations, ionized impurities, crystal defects, other electrons, all kinds of things that they can scatter off of. So there's some kind of random walk. But there's a small bias near equilibrium. There's a small tendency for them to go from left to right because of that electric field or that positive voltage that we've applied here that's trying to get them to flow this way. So this is what we call diffusive transport. You know, even though there's an electric field and it's not just diffusion, it's drift, we call it diffusive transport when the sample is many mean free paths long. A mean free path is, you know, the average distance between these scattering events. So there's an electric field. It's just the voltage divided by the length. There's a minus sign there because it points to the left. And you'll remember that an electric field puts a force on an electron. That's minus Q times the electric field. Right? If you're an electrical engineer, Q is the magnitude of the charge on an electron. If you're a physicist, it has a sign. So we'll write it as magnitude of the charge. So if you read physics books, you always have to keep that straight. And you'll remember that if you have an electric field, then what it does is it causes these electrons to drift at an average velocity that's proportional to the electric field, and the constant of proportionality is the mobility. All right? If there were no scattering, the electric field would just accelerate them, and they would just go faster and faster. But if there's a lot of scattering, the scattering slows them down. The electric field exerts a force that wants to accelerate them. The scattering exerts a force that wants to decelerate them. And it all balances out that you just get velocity is proportional to electric field. Okay. So then we can compute the current flowing through here. It's easy. Current is just charge divided by time. You know, how much charge is there in this resistor? Well, I've got an electron density per cubic centimeter times Q. That's the charge density per cubic centimeter. I have a cross-sectional area A, and I have a length L. So that's the volume is A times L. So that's the total amount of charge in the semiconductor. In a time called the transit time, all of that charge moves out. Transit time is just the length of that resistor divided by the average velocity that they're flowing at. So in that time, all of that charge leaves. So all I have to do is to divide those two, and I'll get current is carrier density times charge times average velocity times cross-sectional area. And the average velocity is minus mu times the electric field. Okay. So I can write the current as nq mu, A, cross-sectional area divided by length times voltage. Or I can recognize this as conductance times voltage. The conductance is just nq mu times A over L. Nq mu are some material properties, depending on how I doped the semiconductor, on what its effective mass and scattering is like. So that's the conductivity. And right, so that's a very standard relation. Most of you have probably seen that. If you've seen it, raise your hand. All right. Where does it come from? I mean, these are very simple arguments. They look very plausible, but we're going to ask some questions like, you know, these days we're interested in resistors. It may be a big chunk of semiconductor that's very long, like the one I just discussed. It might be a quantum well where electrons are confined in one direction. They're only free to move in two directions. It might be a nanowire where electrons are confined in two directions and they're only free to move in one direction. And it might be many mean free paths long, or it might be very short so that the electrons go across without scattering. Right? We can make very small devices these days. So one of the first things we're going to want to understand is how we compute the conductance or the resistance of any conductor, long or short, any material in 1D, 2D, or 3D, because we use all dimensions here very commonly. And we're going to want to understand how to do it not just in common semiconductors like silicon, germanium, gallium arsenide. You know, we're going to want to gain some understanding so that when we encounter new research problems like graphene, we're not stumped. Say, okay, this is just another material. We know what determines conductance. We can compute the conductance of a sheet of graphene. We can compute its mobility. Or what about this? You know, people have done experiments at some time ago now where they put two probes on a hydrogen molecule, right, H2, and measured its resistance. You know, what's the resistance? Right? You start, you know, if you say, well, okay, the conductance is NQ mu, right? Should we be talking about a mobility for this thing? You know, what is N? What electrons and what energy level? Okay. But we'll find that this is very easy to think about, right? We should be able to compute the IV characteristics of anything that through which current flows, because we're using those more and more. And then we'll find that, you know, it's not just applying a voltage that causes current to flow. What if I go back to that resistor and what if I heat up the right end, make it hotter than the left end? Okay, so if I had shorted this resistor, you can kind of see that what would happen. Intuitively, you can think that the hot electrons are going to want to diffuse away from the heat, right? I mean, if that end of the room were really hot, you'd all want to sit over in this end of the room, right? The electrons are going to do the same thing. If we open circuit it, well, then the current can't flow. The electrons want to diffuse away from the heat. An electric field has to get set up to pull them back and cause the current to stop. If there's an electric field, it means that there's a voltage difference. So if I put a high impedance voltmeter here so that no current flows, I'll measure a voltage difference. Okay. That voltage difference is proportional to the temperature difference. The constant of proportionality we'll call S. It's called the Seebeck coefficient. And it's negative for N-type and positive for P-type. Sometimes you'll hear it called the thermal power. So it's something that sometimes affects devices just because we happen to have temperature gradients present. Sometimes we're trying to build devices like thermoelectric coolers. These little picnic coolers, have anybody have these? You plug in a little battery, it cools your drink. Sometimes they're embedded in car seats now. They're used frequently to precision cooling for electronic devices like lasers and things where you need very stable temperature control. So you can build useful devices out of this effect as well. So it's been known for a long, long time, but it's still very important, and people are still trying to figure out how to enhance the effects and make better devices based on them. And we'd like to understand physically, what is this all about? How do we compute the Seebeck coefficient for a material? How do we enhance the Seebeck coefficient? Okay, so small temperature differences will give rise to linear transport. Current will be proportional to the temperature difference. Small voltage differences will give rise to linear transport. Current will be proportional to the voltage difference. Now, if we get up here in high voltages, things become nonlinear. Now, so if it's silicon, it has a nice characteristic like this. The simplest thing that you could conceive of doing is saying that, well, okay, near equilibrium, this is just a material parameter that you can look up, right? Determined by the properties of the semiconductor. Over here, I could say, well, okay, current is still conductance times voltage, but conductance is some complicated thing that depends on the electric field. It gets smaller when the electric field gets very big. You might have dealt with a field-dependent mobility when you analyze silicon devices or run simulation programs with it. Now, it's not at all obvious. That sounds like a very sensible thing to do, but when you actually think about what are we doing here? How can we get away with this? It's not so easy to justify. And in fact, if you look in small electron devices, things like small transistors these days, if you put a volt across a small MOSFET these days, you get an enormous electric field. So you might be led to believe that, well, if the electric field is that high, the electrons will travel at 1 times 10 to the 7th. They can't go any faster than that in silicon. So this is a computer simulation done several years ago now from some people at IBM. And what you see, this is an energy band diagram. So this is a MOSFET. Here's the source. Here we're coming into the channel. Here's the potential dropping down the channel. And then here's the drain. So the electron energy is minus Q times voltage. So the drain is energy is lower here because we've applied a positive voltage to the drain. Each dot is an electron that's tracked through the semiconductor with random numbers to try to mimic the scattering processes and the physics that goes on. We'll learn, I don't think we'll write any computer program, but we'll learn, doing this, it's really a very simple concept for how people do these kind of simulations. We'll learn how that all works in the course. But look at here. If you just go to any point in this MOSFET and pick off every electron and determine, add up all their velocities and divide by the number, so compute the average velocity versus position, this is what it looks like. It's low in the source. It's low in the drain. You get in the channel, it pops up, and it gets very high. And look in that high field regime, where the field is so high that you would think in bulk silicon electrons can't go faster than 10 to the 7th, but look at where 10 to the 7th is here. The electrons are going faster than the saturated velocity throughout the entire channel. And this peak here is called velocity overshoot. So it actually helps the performance of a device. Right? Electrons are going much higher than you would have expected based on your understanding of bulk silicon, and we'll try to understand where this comes from. And what we'll find is that when the electric field is varying rapidly in space or in time, you can't talk about a field-dependent mobility or things like that. You can get some unusual effects that go on. And then, of course, people make devices smaller and smaller all the time. So this particular simulation is a semi-classical simulation. So we're thinking about each of these electrons as an almost classical particle. It obeys equations that are analogous to Newton's law. It's just that the energy band structure has modified it. So we have an effective mass instead of the vacuum mass of an electron, things like that. But we think of them as classical particles. But channel lengths are getting smaller and smaller these days. Our industrial sponsors tell us that if you're working on transistors in university research, you should only be working on transistors that have channel lengths that are 8 nanometers or below, because that's the research frontier right now. 8 nanometers is pretty small, and it means that you have to start worrying a lot about quantum mechanics, and you have to start thinking about these electrons as quantum mechanical particles. So This is a simulation using a quantum transport approach called non-equilibrium Green's function of the electron density in a MOSFET under high bias. This particular case is ballistic. There's no scattering at all. And wherever it's red, it means there's a high density of electrons. You can see here's the conduction band, right? There's supposed to be no states under the bottom of the conduction band, but you see there are a lot of electrons there. Those are electrons that are tunneling underneath that barrier. You can see some of them are reflecting off and setting up interference patterns. So really the challenge of scaling silicon transistors as far as they possibly can be, one of the challenges is in learning how you control these quantum mechanical tunneling effects and reflection effects. Now, we're not going to talk a lot about this, but I'll give you an introduction. You should know, basically, it's not hard to appreciate what's going on in simulations like these, when you need to use them, how you interpret results. If you read a paper and you see plots where people are doing these simulations, we want to be able to interpret what we're seeing and make sense of it. So we'll have a lecture or two, but not any more than that on quantum transport. Okay, I mentioned prerequisites just briefly. You know, I'm trying to teach this course assuming that you've only had EE606. I'm not completely sure that's possible. You know, you'll have to tell me how it works. But that's the way I've been trying to teach it. If you've had Fundamentals of Nanoelectronics from Professor Datta, you've probably seen a lot of the concepts that we're going to be talking about. How many of you have had that course? Okay. It shouldn't be necessary, but it's helpful, I think, if you've had the course, and if you've had a solid-state physics course and you know things like a little more about energy bands and quantum mechanics and phonons, that's helpful too. But we're only going to be using a few basic concepts. If you're going to be working in this field, you'll want to go back and take those courses later to fill in the details and get a deeper knowledge of them. But in order to understand how carriers move in semiconductors and devices, we just need a few concepts from solid-state physics and band structure and things like that. That's the level we'll try to keep it on. Okay, the textbook is still this one I wrote. I wrote this a long time ago when the students in the course complained that they had to have a textbook. They didn't like just doing it by class notes. We'll still use about two-thirds of it. You know, I'm hoping next time I teach it, it might not be the assigned course textbook. But it still is. We'll still be using it for two-thirds. The first third of the course is actually some new lecture notes that are more or less done. You know, they'll be published sometime this fall or next spring. I'll be making a set of those available to you on the website, pre-publication. Don't pass them around to anyone else, you know, because I want to find the typos and do the corrections, and I don't want all of these first versions out there, right? So use it yourself, but don't email it to your friends, right? It's going to come out. I mean, and actually the publisher is being very nice and is allowing us, when it's published, you can buy the book or you can download the PDF file free of charge. So people will be able to get it, but let's keep it within this class until we get it all sorted out. Okay, the lecture format, they're going to be PowerPoint lectures like this mostly, but you can interrupt with questions. I'll just repeat them so that we get it captured for the videotape. I will try my best to post the PowerPoint lecture on the website shortly before the lecture. It will usually be shortly before because it won't be finalized until shortly before. Right. This lecture was on there. If any of you saw it. Did anybody find it? All right. Okay. We're also going to record and deploy these. So if you'd like to see the lecture over again, you can do that. And, you know, Joe and his team are going to make their best effort at getting these up fairly soon, but they're doing a lot of other things too. You know, so you shouldn't feel that you can skip the lecture and just watch it online, because they may get tied up with some other projects and you might not see it for a week or two, right? But we'll do the best that we can to do that. The previous offering of this 2 years ago is online, so many of those lectures are still relevant. And I'm going to hold office hours immediately after class, right upstairs, room 343B. So if you have questions and they're still fresh in your mind and you're available then, we can do it then. Otherwise, you can email me and we can see if we can do it by email. On the course webpage, you know, there is a facility to have an online discussion, and we'll see if that works. So if you have a question and it seems to me to be a question that would be of interest to others in the class, you know, I may post the question and the answer there so that the other students can see that too. All right, how about the grading? So, all right, 25% homework. So I'm going to assign it and collect it But since I'm going to be spending so much time on these lectures, I don't have time to grade it. But that shouldn't matter to senior graduate students or best efforts. You know, I'll collect it. I'll post solutions. You should do it. You can't possibly learn the material unless you do it. And I'll have office hours. You can ask questions. I won't return it. I'll keep them. If I get down to the end of the course and, you know, you had a bad day on one of the exams, you're borderline, you know, then I can go to the relevant homework and then I can grade it and I can use that as a deciding point. So if you don't think you're going to be near the borderline, you might say, I don't have to do the homework. But, you know, you can't learn the material. You really can't learn the material unless you do the homework. And if you found other people's solutions and you copy them, you're just kidding yourself. You know, you might say, okay, I see what he's doing. No, you don't really see what they're doing unless you actually struggle with it and do it yourself. So I urge you to do the homework. There are two exams that are 25% each. Last time I taught it, I think I made one of them a take-home exam. So let me think a little bit more about, you know, what's appropriate for those. And then the final exam is also 25%. There is a web page, and we're going to put it on NanoHub this year. So I'm still learning how to use everything, but you should get familiar with this. It's listed on the course syllabus. So if you go there, all of the homework will be posted there. Homework solutions will be posted in a place that only the members of this class can get to. The lectures, we'll point you to the lectures when they come available. The PDF files of the lectures before the recorded lectures are posted on the web will be available there. So get familiar with it. You know, if I have an announcement to make, I'll put the announcement here too. All right. So it's really helpful if you go there, you can see that there is a lecture by lecture schedule and reading assignments for every lecture. I think it's really helpful if you look at those, do the reading beforehand. It makes more sense. And then to review the lecture after class. So you can print out the PowerPoint slides and maybe go through and refresh your memory, take notes on it. I understand people that have done studies about this say, you know, if you just listen to a lecture, then a few days later, you've forgotten something like 75% of it. Your short-term memory isn't very good. But if you just go through the process of writing down what you heard on paper, even if you throw that away, it's helped to embed it in your longer-term memory. So it's a useful thing to do. All right, I already told you about doing the homework. I put it in bold because it's important. You know, you should also be reading the field, things like transactions on electron devices, electron device letters, applied physics letters, Journal of Applied Physics. You'll see seminars all the time here. Speakers will be coming in giving seminars. Many of these will be relating to things that we're talking about in the course. And if you find something interesting there that you think is relevant, bring it to my attention. And if I can discuss it in class and find a way to do that, work up a homework problem related to it. You know, we'll try to do something like that. And ask me questions. Even though, you know, the PowerPoint format doesn't encourage questions, you can ask me questions. And the people listening to it might appreciate that. And the office hours are right after class, so you can ask your questions there too. And as I said, you know, monitor the course homepage because everything related to the course should appear on that. Okay, so now for your next steps, what you should do is you should send an email to Vicki Johnson and you should ask to join the ECE 656 group. Now to do that, she'll have to know your NanoHub login. How many people have a NanoHub login? All right? So most of you are already set. If you don't have one, you'll have to request one. You get one immediately. And then she will give you access to the restricted part of that page. You know, most everything is open, but there'll be a few places like those lecture notes and things where unless you're on the list, you won't get access to it. So do that right away. There'll probably be a few issues that we have to sort out because this is the first time we're using this, but we'll get those all sorted out. I'm going to try to assign a homework problem for each lecture. Okay, so, you know, rather than doing a bunch. So I'm going to assign them. They'll be due 1 week later. So you'll get a problem to think about each time. If you keep up with them, then you won't have this big group that you all have to do at once. So homework one is posted there. And get familiar with the website. See what's there and what you can get access to. Have a look at homework one. Now, I'm going to, and this might happen from time to time, one of the things that I wanted to do today, but I didn't think I would have time for, and we only have 15 minutes left, was to review some basic concepts about band structure that you will need for this course. And actually, there's a lecture devoted to this. You can find that. Either if you Google ECE 656, you'll find the course. If you go to the course homepage, you'll find the lectures from the previous time. So view lecture one from fall 2009. Right? It's just a review of things that you probably already know about band structure, but just to get you, you know, it's summer. Summer's over. We have to get back in the groove again. So it'll get you in the right frame of mind for the course, and homework one is based on that lecture. All right. Who's got questions? No questions? All right, you'll have to do better than this in the future. All right, well, I will see you here Tuesday, and as I said, this first week is just some review or a few basic concepts. You know, it's really important this first week. There are some things that we're just going to use over and over again, and I assume that you know how to do. It's worth spending some time in the first week and in the first few homework assignments and making sure you're solid on that, because it'll make the rest of the course a lot easier. Okay, good luck in the course.